Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Hey Dad, how you doing?
Good, Tay, how you doing? Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Doing alright. Alright, did you, it was the Halloween weekend. Did you have anything good to drink?
Well, actually, yeah, I had two days of partying. It was very unlike me.
Two days of partying?
Yeah, had my favorite espresso martinis Friday night while we sat out on the back porch enjoying a fire and watching the leaves fall around us. And then Saturday went to the Marshall game. Unfortunately, wasn't much of a game. But
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, we tailgated, and I had my Guinness, brought my Guinness draft along, drank those. Then we went in. There's a new beer that they've developed in conjunction with Country Boy Brewers. That's Herd Country Lager.
Oh, so, that's nice.
Yeah, named after the Thundering Herd. So I had to have me a couple of Herd Country Lagers. They were good, too.
It's good, yeah?
Yeah.
Just like a light lager kind of vibe?
Yeah, just a light lager. It's in a pretty green can with a raging buffalo on it. That's nice. The Herd. Yeah.
It was just a trending tweet, but somebody had handed out, obviously, candy for kids, and then they had little bottles of Fireball that they put, like, little tissue paper ghosts over the top, you know?
Yeah.
So those were the adult treats, and I thought that was very cute. I feel like that's a good thing maybe to work in to your Halloween giveaway next Halloween. There's a kid's candy and some adult candy.
Yeah. I'd go back to that house several times.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I'd bring along a couple of extra masks, so if somebody was giving out, like, full-size candy bars, I could go around the corner and switch my mask and come back and get another one, so I'd have to maybe pull that trick out and get the extra bottles of booze.
I was, so in my neighborhood, obviously, I'm in Brooklyn, people don't go door-to-door because every door is an apartment building, but there's, like, a main street with a lot of businesses on it. And all the businesses will give out candy. And the kids, like, I was out, I had some shopping to do, so I just happened to be out while all the kids were going up and down. Knickerbocker is the street close by. And I was going to the pet store, or not the pet store, it doesn't sell pets, it sells pet food and pet supplies. And I guess they'd run out of candy already, and they had a sign up that said, "No more candy," with a sad face. And there were two little boys in costume walking right in front of me, and one of them saw the door and just went up, opened the door, and just leaned in and said, "You suck!" Walked away.
Sound like something Cooper would do.
Right, it was just so, like, he saw that sign, he's like, "No way, pet store, you're not getting away with this." I walked in, and the old lady behind the counter was like, "What was that?" I was like, "God, shit. You need to get some candy, ma'am. It's early in the night. This could get worse."
These kids are turning on you.
Yeah.
They've got fire.
Just put out some of those fancy dog treats. They taste like cookies. I know from experience.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what about you? Do you have any spooky cocktails?
I didn't go out at all. Well, that's not true. I went to a Halloween drag show Sunday early, and this place in my neighborhood called Dromedary Bar, which it's a good tiki bar, and they had a special Halloween menu. They had a cocktail called a Black Phillip, which is a reference to the movie The Witch, and it had black sesame syrup in it, and I think it was rum base. I forget. It was good, though.
It was good.
They had a really cute menu. They had one that was like a Lost Boy-themed cocktail. And, you know, like the scene where Michael, the one vampire, is eating the noodles from the Chinese takeaway?
Yeah.
And it turns into worms?
Yeah.
And it so it came in a little Chinese takeaway container. The cocktail did, like, with a cup in down in it, and then had worms, gummy worms coming out of it. Very, very cute, very original delivery for a cocktail. I was very impressed by that.
Yeah, in a Chinese food box, that's pretty pretty good.
Smart. I liked it. So I did get to have,
Well, did you eat the gummy worms?
Well, it was my friend got the, I got the Black Phillip. My friend got the Lost Boys cocktail. So I did not. Those were his gummy worms.
Oh, all right.
But they always have fun cocktails year round. But of course, Halloween is behind us. But while we're recording today, we are still, there is still a holiday happening. It is Dia de los Muertos, which is November 1st through the 2nd, also sometimes to the 6th, sort of this time period.
Nebulous time period.
Yeah. But of course, Day of the Dead is what that translates to.
Right.
And this is not, if you're not familiar with it, I know we've talked about it in the past, but just a little refresher. It's not Mexican Halloween. It's its own holiday. It's a completely unrelated celebration, despite existing
proximity
the same
to
period.
Halloween. Yeah,
I think it's cool that lots of cultures unrelated to each other have a celebration of, like, either those who have passed on or the thinning of the veil all around the same time period. Like, I don't know. I'm a bit of a believer, so I'm more likely to lean into something like this. But I feel like it means there's something spooky going on, right? Like, Japan has the Obon Festival, which is somewhat similar. It's a celebration of the dead, and it takes place in the fall. I mean, it could also just be that the fall. Like, I get it. And leaves are dying. It's that time period. But I don't know. Maybe there's something going on.
Well, I thought it had something to do with the equinox or something, too.
Well, there's, like, the shortening of the days. The Dia de los Muertos has roots. It's kind of arguable where the roots start, but some dated all the way back to, like, Aztec culture. So it is, it's been around for a minute. And it is very much a joyous celebration. It's not meant for mourning the dead. It's meant for celebrating the dead, welcoming them back. This is when you build your altar or your ofrendas with food and drink, offerings to the dead. You play music, you dance, you write fun epitaphs for people that have passed. It's a very joyous celebration.
Yeah, most of what I know about it came from Charlie's school last year, had to do presentations on it and what it was. So I learned some from that. And then also, we got to go watch the movie Coco.
Yes.
And that movie Coco, that's what it was all about. And I understood it much better after watching the movie. And I didn't think I would enjoy it nearly as much as I did. I enjoyed it way too much, and it made me cry.
It's a wonderful movie. I love that movie. I might watch it tonight. Coco's a gorgeous film. It's a lovely holiday. I think it's great to center a holiday around remembering, celebrating, making connection with people that are no longer with us. It doesn't have to be sad. It can be joyous.
Right.
And I thought, along with that, we haven't done a famous drinker episode in a minute. So there's one that I've proposed it to you before, and I'm like, no, I don't think I want to do that. It's going to make me sad. But I thought this was the right time for it. I would like to dedicate this episode to somebody who, despite never meeting the man, made a big impact on my life, and that is a very famous drinker, a very beloved traveler, chef, writer, humanitarian, punk rock guy in the restaurant industry, Anthony Bourdain.
Yes, we'll celebrate his spirit and wish him well in this time frame.
Yeah. I can say assuredly that this show that you're currently listening to, I don't think it would exist if it weren't for Anthony Bourdain. He pretty much single-handedly is responsible for my career in the food and beverage industry. Again, despite the fact that we never met, his influence on me absolutely had a direct impact on my life that I am grateful for. however meandering my life and career might look like from the outside, I am grateful for it. So,
yeah, he was a very unique individual with a very unique background. His grandparents were French. Mm-hmm. Thus the name Bourdain. And then also another thing that he grew up under was he had a Catholic father and a Jewish mother. So there's some real extremes of religion in the same household, even though they didn't consider themselves religious.
Yeah, they weren't. Neither were practicing.
Right.
Yeah, Anthony Bourdain. He was born June 25th, 1956. He was born here in Manhattan, here in New York. And although he spent most of his young life in Jersey. And yeah, I love the way he talks about his childhood. He says he has a very stable, loving childhood. He says, "I did not want for love or attention. My parents loved me. Neither of them drank to excess. Nobody beat me. God was never mentioned, so I was annoyed by neither church nor any notion of sin or damnation." I love that.
Yeah, it's like all the things that people complain about their parents did to screw them up. And he says, "My parents didn't do any of those."
Nope. No religion, no violence. It's just all me. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, his father's family was French, and that had a very big sort of planted those seeds of his interest in a culinary career, because he has in one of his books, he talks about like visiting France on a family trip when he was young and like experiencing his first raw oyster and how impactful that was, the texture and the flavor and the understanding of like terroir, of like consuming something where it should be consumed with elements of the place it's raised or it's made. Like that's a big impactful experience for him. And would continue, you know, through his young adulthood. He worked in restaurants. He went to college for a few years, but ultimately like decided to pursue the career of a chef.
Yeah. He basically went to college just cause he was following his girlfriend that he had in high school, and she was a year ahead of him, so he went ahead and got his credits to graduate early so he could go to college with her, and they went to Vassar, which had just recently let males come in. It was all female, and they just recently let males come in, so I think that kind of influenced him, too. That was a pretty good time to go there, because he probably was like a 10-to-1 ratio girls to guys.
Hey, he had a girlfriend.
Well, yeah, but if she dumped him, then, you know, the odds were in his favor.
Yeah, well, I guess that's fair. Well, I mean, he dumped the college, though. He was only there for, what, 2 years?
Right, yeah.
And then, you know, he had this experience of working in the kitchen at a seafood restaurant while going to school, and then just ultimately decided, this is my path. He attended the Culinary Institute of America, and from there, that opened the door to working in some of the most popular kitchens at the time in New York. You know, he's probably best known as far as his work as a chef for being the executive chef at L'Aigle, which was a very well-known French brasserie in New York up until, I think, 2017 is when it declared bankruptcy and closed. And I mean, it was working off of his legacy, I think, for a while. Like, he was the executive chef there, and then he got big enough that he wasn't working there anymore. But L'Aigle kept the notion of Anthony Bourdain as their main selling point for a while, long after he wasn't cooking there.
They called him their chef at large.
Which is hilarious. I love that.
It's kind of like chef on the loose, more like it.
Yeah. Well, I knew some people that worked there back when it was still operational. And they, well, he would not, he was far too famous at that point. He didn't work shifts anymore, but he would come in a lot, and it was cool to hear. Like, he had a set table, and, you know, kind of people knew what he was going to order. But he was also just like a very, not to the surprise of nobody, he was a very gracious customer, mm-hmm. always, just, you know,
sure,
don't give mm-hmm. me any special attention, like, just, you know, when you can get to me, it's fine. While working in the kitchen, he began writing both fiction and nonfiction. His first few novels were actually mystery novels.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me. It makes sense that he would write like cookbooks or books about being a chef, but he had a real interest in mysteries and writing nonfiction things. I mean, fiction things.
Yeah. And they got published. They weren't massive successes. His first real big success was actually in 2000 with the publication of Kitchen Confidential, which is sort of a behind the scenes look at the restaurant world in all of its wildness. And that's really what earned him his first big spotlight. It was a bestseller. And it was followed by two more sort of similar style True Life bestsellers, A Cook's Tour and The Nasty Bits.
And then there was another one that he wrote that I would like to read, because we covered this on Court Appointed, was Typhoid Mary.
Oh, yeah.
The true story of it.
Yeah.
And he wrote a hypothetical historical investigation of Typhoid Mary, which, of course, was an Irish-born cook that was believed to have infected 53 people with typhoid fever.
Yeah, he's also done, this was a little bit after everything. He did some comics too. He did a completely fictional comic called, I think it was Get Jiro. And then there was also one that I own that I really love is a compilation of stories all centered around cooks, but they're ghost stories, and it's called The Hungry Ghosts, which is really, really good. So he very prolific with his writing. And his writing is what launched him into his TV career. A Cook's Tour was made into a sort of a short series of episodes in, what was that, 2002 to 2003. Mm-hmm. And then that went on to sort of be redeveloped into No Reservations, which, of course, was what he's possibly best known for TV-wise, which ran for almost a decade. It started in 2005, ended in 2012. And that's really when he kind of became a household name.
Yeah, he started picking up all his fame from being on TV. And I think that a lot of that, too, started changing what he was looking at. I mean, it kind of started out with these different cuisines, but he started kind of associating that with the food not only nourished the body, but nourished the soul and nourished the mind and nourished the community and everything else. And he started seeing that connection. And I think that's why everybody kind of related to him in these things, is it was much more than just food that he would talk about.
Well, and I think it was also, it was that, and it was the kind of food that he was highlighting. You know, I remember, and really this is where my sort of fascination with him began, is I was always fascinated by travel shows. Like, that was just something that I would watch, you know, just to entertain myself. But I would watch travel shows like Samantha Brown. Do you remember Samantha Brown? She was always on like a yacht or in like a 4-star hotel. She was always eating like a 10-course meal somewhere. It's very fancy. I would watch her show with the same mindset like I would watch, I don't know, Lord of the Rings. Like, this is complete fantasy. I will never know experiences like this, but it's cool to see.
Sure.
But Anthony Bourdain, his show wasn't like that. He made it clear, like, in the kind of food he consumed, you know, he was eating food at street carts. He was eating at little, you know, like hole in the wall places, delis. I mean, he had an episode where he went to West Virginia and just like drank at dive bars and stuff. And like, you know, like he was going to places that felt within reach. And he was emphasizing that not only is it that you can have a good experience in a place on a budget, it was more like the culture actually exists best in like the everyman, the working man, the stuff you can't afford, you know, like screw all that expensive upper class stuff. That's garbage. The real good stuff is here with like people that they're just the same, you know, they're just like you. They're just in another country. Those are who you want to meet. Those are the people that hold the real roots to their culture. And it was the first time in my life that it ever felt like travel was something that I could actually access, that I could visualize, that the rest of the world would not be closed to me for my entire life, that I could not only just could, that I should seek it out.
Yeah, he didn't just go to 4- and 5-star restaurants all around the world and sample what their most expensive meal was. He went to villages and sat on the ground and ate what the people of the village would eat and understood how they, you know, how they cooked it, how they grew it, you know, how it came to be, why it was so important, why it was a staple for them, and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. Not just going around, traveling around, enjoying. It wasn't like, what was that guy, the Adventures of the Rich and Famous?
You know? Yeah, well, he also exhibited like a real, the only time, I love that you never saw him express disgust, no matter how, like, quote-unquote strange a food was. He was always very appreciative, very grateful. The only time you saw him exhibit disgust was at, like, pretension. Or you know, you're hijacking a culture's cuisine, and you're raising the price, and you're removing it from the people. Like, he would be harsh and judgmental, but it was only when he felt like people were being inauthentic, were being, you know, like, we're trying to capitalize off of a culture, another people's culture. Like, I love that about him. You know, he was not mm-hmm. afraid to call people out, but it was a very specific type of call out.
Yeah, and then he got himself caught up because he got in the habit of kind of being critical of other chefs who basically started pandering to their fame instead of their actual, you know, instead of actually cooking. And so he started talking about that. Then I think it suddenly dawned on him, hey, I'm one of those kind of guys too. So then he kind of changed his whole opinion about it and backed off on him. So,
which is it's such an example of his humility, because I don't think you would ever put him on that same level. Like, he wasn't a celebrity chef. He was a chef and he was a celebrity, but you know, he made his celebrity by being honest and grateful and, you know, illustrating other cultures and other parts of the world for us in a very, you know, humanitarian way. But he still allowed, like, he had that level of humility. That's like, well, I guess I'm kind of like these guys. It's like, no, you're not. But also, it's cool that you, that you're that humble about what you do. Mm-hmm. I also appreciate that, you know, he was somebody that could freak, like, he would change his opinions on things, you know, like, it famously, like, went on rants about, like, what's his name? Lagasse, Emil Lagasse.
Oh, Emeril.
Emeril.
Yeah.
And then eventually, like, they buried the hatchet and, like, had a meal together. Like, I like that about him. Like, he was somebody that would express strong beliefs, but was always willing to change them or renegotiate them based on new information. I mean, even, like, you know, I am a vegan now. I wasn't for a long time. But, like, you know, he'd make a lot of offhand jokes at the sake of vegans or vegetarians. But then also, like, he came around to it eventually. Like, no, you know. Like, factory farming is bad. It's bad for farmers. It's bad for people. We probably eat too much meat. I respect the convictions of vegans and vegetarians. Like, you know, it was okay with, like, admitting that there was nuance to things, that people could have different beliefs and you could have respect for each other.
Yeah, it was always also the religious aspect of it. Some people, their religion made them, steered them towards being vegan or vegetarian.
Well, like, I don't think he was ever there to... It's weird when people kind of file him in with food critic, because I don't think critic was he was never a critic of food, again, unless it felt like pretentious or elitist. He was just an experiencer. Like, he experienced things and he shared those experiences with us and tried to communicate the importance of the experience. He didn't judge it.
A food and travel enthusiast.
Yeah. But it really, I mean, you know, I remember at the time, like, I mean, his work came into my life. I was in college here in New York for art, and I was so disenchanted with the art world, because it just felt so, like, I went into cartooning, and I felt like that was kind of safe from a sort of pretension or elitism. Like, it wasn't cool to make comics, so that meant you could be passionate and loving about it. In the way that the rest of the art world was kind of devoid of. But unfortunately, like, my time period also, like, was at the same time as, like, comics becoming an art medium. Like, oh, well, now it's a graphic novel. Now comics can be real art, which is good in one sense, but also bad in the sense that it meant that now we can be pretentious about comics, too. And I just... nothing repels me more than that. I feel like pretentiousness and elitism are opposite of creativity and passion. Like, they take everything beautiful and earnest and communicative about an art form and they kind of nail it to the wall and they take all the life out of it. So I was very disenchanted with the art world, you know. I was, like, working really hard to get internships where I was working for free, and I knew that wasn't tenable out of college. I went to college on loans. So it was like, where is my path here? I don't have a path into the art world, because the entry level jobs all need a trust fund to afford to work. Like, that's not you know, and like the barrier right. between me and creating things is so far and so many years, and I want to create now. I mean, it's kind of a weird loner. Like, my way of communication is I'm not good with words. I make things with my hands, and this is how I communicate. And I will suffocate if I can't do that. And I started working in restaurants in my summers between semesters so I could afford to stay in the city. And I found like I was way more in line with the people there. Like, these are people, they're working with their hands, they're making things every day. You wake up, you make things, you make experiences, you make food, you make drinks, and there's no pretension. You know, there's not, unfortunately, there's a lack of respect for the jobs you do, but because of that, it has to be good. There's no amount of bullshitting that you mm-hmm. can put in. Like, it has to be good. And that was around the time that I discovered his TV show. And I just remember one of those, you know, sort of confluence of events, walking into the bar I was working at. I was working at the Hop Devil on St. Mark's. Mm-hmm. And the bartender was reading Kitchen Confidential. And I recognized the name, Anthony Bourdain, from No Reservations. I was like, oh, I like his show. And the bartender's like, you got to read his book. And I went out and I bought his book. And, you know, I always felt kind of ashamed of working at the restaurant in the summer. Because, like, you know, my friends that had money, they would just be artists all summer long. I had to work. I worked during the school year, too. Like, that was just what I did. I wanted money when I graduated, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and that was sort of a shameful thing to me. Like, oh, you're not a real artist. You work in a restaurant. But he made working in a restaurant sound cool and punk rock and respectable in the way that I cared about respect, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, this is, you can have self-respect and do this job. And that meant a lot to me. And that really, like, when I graduated, the choice between what, like, trying to manage an unpaid internship and just hope that they'll pay me before my money runs out, or going to work full time in a restaurant and having money and safety and security, and I'm working with my hands, I'm making things, I'm going to choose that.
And you created opportunities to travel too.
Well, and that too, you know, I got a lot of people kind of gave me the side eye when I'm like, yeah, I worked for a year to save up $600 so I could buy a ticket to go to Dublin. Like, well, that's a waste of money. You should invest that. Like, invest into what? I'm investing it into the experience. You know, yeah. I can say that I've had pints of Guinness in Dublin. I'm glad I did that.
Well, and one of the things that Anthony Bourdain demonstrated is that you learn and grow as a person the more you know and understand other cultures. Because when you get too centered on everything is all about what I see every day, then you lose sight of the bigger picture. And traveling and seeing how other people live, the good things and the bad things that other people and cultures and countries have to put up with, it's got to affect you if you're any kind of a person, that you have a better understanding of man, and maybe you become more tolerant and things like that. So I think that he was trying to demonstrate those type of characteristics too.
That's true. I think it's specifically, I feel like why he was so, because I know it wasn't just my experience. I think that maybe more than any like recent celebrity figure, when I bring up Anthony Bourdain in mixed company, I feel like more people than not have a moment of like, that he meant something to me. He was important to me. And I feel like, especially as Americans, like travel was not, it's not a thing, it's a thing we're capable of, but it's not a thing that we have an importance on. It's a luxury, it's an excess, it's unnecessary. A lot of the world doesn't feel that way, and a lot of the world also is in close enough proximity to other experiences that it's more part of your youth that you go and you travel and you see other things. But I think mm-hmm. it's a cultural problem in America that we don't see the rest of the world. You know, when I think about, I don't know, when I think about Turkey, it's not an abstract idea. I can remember people I met and things I ate and, you know, buildings. Like, I can remember specifics. It humanizes the world when you go out there in it. And that's important for understanding the value of places beyond yourself. Like, mm-hmm. it's a bit of a crisis, I think, that we don't have those experiences built in our country.
Well, I mean, the language barrier is another one. You go to another country and, you know, maybe the majority of the people don't speak English. So you have to learn how to cope with that. So then you turn around and you come back to your own country, and then you maybe have a better understanding of those that come here that are still working with learning the language and stuff. You know, so there's things like that that you learn firsthand how to deal with those things, or you understand other people that are dealing with that. You know,
well, it's also it's odd because it's also an experience in the kitchen and in the restaurant world. You know, I mean, here in New York, I don't think I've worked in a single kitchen that you're dealing with a bunch of like people that were born in America. There's a lot of immigrants working kitchens, working restaurants, mm-hmm. and I have tried to learn a second language most of my life. I am barely passable in like a decade and a half of like studying Japanese. And then I just work with dudes that'll speak three languages, you know, like just standard, like every bus boys that you work with that speak two languages, like they're already ahead of you in a way mm-hmm. that you can't even like understand. Like it's an important experience. I feel like that happens. And that was everything that he made a point to highlight. You know, I love this. I mean, speaking of kitchen staff, there's this quote that has always stuck with me. He says, "I love the sheer weirdness of kitchen life. The dreamers, the crackpots, the refugees, the sociopath with whom I continue to work. The professional kitchen is the last refugee of the misfit. It's a place for people with bad past to find a new family." Like, I feel like when I came to New York, I wanted to find like, you know, I was in the closet. So I wanted to find the queer scene, and I wanted to find the punk scene, and I wanted to like be with artists. And I found like most of the social circles that I wound up in just from like art school were just sort of rich New England kids that had expensive shoes and really strong opinions about my accent. Like, I couldn't relate to them. But when I started working in restaurants, like, these are my people. These are people I can relate to, that I can have conversations with, that have experiences that are different than mine, that can educate me, that I can share my experiences with, that, you know, that get me. Like, that's where I felt like, I don't know, like, you know, is that same? Like, there's a real punk rock culture. It's like the people that just like, I'm going to do this job because it pays the bills and I love it and I'm passionate and it's outside of society in a weird way.
Well, I think another thing that was cool about Anthony Bourdain is, despite all his successes, you know, as a chef and as an author and being on TV and making the different shows and won all kinds of awards, he never took himself real serious. So like he portrayed himself in several cartoons that were doing things of him. Like, he was on The Simpsons, he was on Archer, and he voiced his own cartoon for them in the thing, and he played along with them. And if that little of that, you know, was a little bit at his expense, he was okay with it. So, you know, I thought that shows his humility, that he was willing to go along and do that.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I don't know if he ever really had, like, he didn't play the game in like the celebrity way. Like, after he passed, there was an article about, like, it talked about the money he left behind. Like, you know, if you assumed how rich he was, oh, he's worth millions. But he had surprisingly little money left over when he passed. And that part of the reason is, like, he spent money on, like, the staff, like, the shows, like, to make sure that people could stay and have experiences in between, you know. He spent money very lavishly, just not on himself, but just to make sure everyone around him was comfortable, you know, if he could put money to, like, people that he encountered, restaurants, whatever. It just wasn't anything that he advertised. He didn't make it part of his personality. It was just something he felt compelled to do. And I don't know. I think that's really... I can't let
that shows he was real. He didn't just play a part, you know. He was real, and he did it in his actions, not just his words.
Yeah, I mean, there's one story that I don't know if it's told about him or if I think this was a secondhand account of somebody that was on the crew that they were shooting somewhere where basically, you know, they were buying food from a food cart in, you know, sort of an impoverished area, and he felt bad that here they'd ordered all this food for them to try, and then all these people are saying they can't even afford the food here, you know, they're hungry. So he was like, well, let's buy the rest of the food that they have. And then the food cart's going to make a bunch of money. And then everybody can have a meal. But it just, there was so much hunger and so much poverty that this food cart became overwhelmed by everybody trying to get food that they'd paid for all this. And he was just sort of devastated over, I want to help, but I don't know how. And mm-hmm. I did something that I thought was good, but I don't think it was good. Because now these poor food cart people are just overwhelmed. And it's just like that willingness, like instead of having a neat and tidy, like not our problem, we're just here to shoot. Like he wanted to help everywhere he went. And I think that's apparent. Mm-hmm. You can read anything he wrote or watch anything he made. And I think that's apparent. His mm-hmm. love for the people that made things and his appreciation for that.
Right. Yeah. It went well beyond the food, yeah. even though that's what he was mostly associated with.
Well, and I think, you know, it reflected again. And he was asked like what his, who do you think the best cook in the world is? Who's the best chef in the world? And his answer was like, I don't know, probably like some grandma cooking in her kitchen in like Mexico or something. Like it's mm-hmm. it's somebody out there making food for the people they love that we'll never encounter. Like it's not
right.
Like it's not quantifiable. That connection mm-hmm. between the people that make things and the quality of the things they make is really beautiful. You know, I don't think it's how I try to conduct myself, you know, in the world of like food service, that you know, there's no hierarchy. It's not this is good and this is bad food. This is lowbrow and this is highbrow. It's if it's made with love and you enjoy it, it has done its task. It is set out. That is the goal, you know? Like that, I don't know. I mean, I feel like every way I try to conduct myself in that realm is from the teachings that I sort of pulled from his writing.
Well, it's kind of like he said about fast food in America. He compared it to the street food in a lot of other countries. And he said, hey, the street food wins hands down over the fast food in this country. So, you know, don't think that we have it better. We might have something we can eat, but they have real food there to deal with.
Well, and then I also love, again, like to the idea that he's willing to present sort of nuanced opinions. There's a great interview where he's talking about Applebee's, about like mm-hmm. a food writer who wrote a really loving review of Applebee's and people, I guess, were mocking her. And he came to her defense and is like, you know what? Like that is her experience. And that is, mm-hmm. that is, if she had a good time, that's all that, like, if she enjoyed what she consumed, that is fine. That is part of America. That's part of our culture. And we don't get to mock it. Like that's not okay. You know, that awareness sure. of, again, like, and I mean, that really spoke to me. Cause like, I don't know. I mean, I don't need to say this to you, like growing up, like going to like an Applebee's or an Outback, that was something mm-hmm. you did when something good happened. That was a celebration, oh, yeah. you know,
sure.
You looked forward uh-huh. to it and you didn't really pick apart. Like nobody sat there with their dish. It was like, I'm sorry. I need to think about this food and decide if it's worthy. No, you were at a celebration. Everyone was there because, I don't know, you won a sports game or you finished a run of a show in community theater. Like, it was yeah. worth celebrating. Somebody had a birthday. And
that was the way Applebee's was, because it was always open late. So after shows, yeah. we could go there and they still serve booze and we could get food. So that was why it got picked a lot in your younger life.
Well, and you know, that you can't separate the experience from the food or the drink. I love that when asked about his favorite drinks, so to bring it back to the topic of the show, he doesn't speak in terms of this thing. He says, oh, this sake I had when I was in Tokyo, or this palm wine I had when I was traveling across Africa. But it's tied to a story. It's tied to an experience. It's tied to, this was good because I enjoyed it, but I also enjoyed everything else around it. And that is the mm-hmm. experience. We can't isolate the food. And to take the food and isolate it from the hands that make it, from the people that made it, from their life, their experience, is a very elitist, pretentious way of approaching it, where it's mm-hmm. it should be tied to the lives of the people that make it. That's the magic. That's where the quality comes in.
Yeah, and that's what he was trying to teach everybody.
Well, and you know, I feel like I always thought, and you know, my career, trying to climb my little ladders, get to the position where I could put drinks on menus and get to eventually make menus of my own. I always thought at some point I would get to have the opportunity to make a drink for the man that, I mean, gave me a place to be. And I always wondered what that drink would be. And I was always so assured that that opportunity would present itself. Like, I'm going to mean enough in this realm that someday I'm going to make a drink for Anthony Bourdain. And, you know, when we got the news, when everybody, you know, woke up that day and he was no longer with us, obviously that's, you know, that's hardly anything in the realm of all of everything lost, like that hardly registers. But I've thought a lot about that. And I think that, you know, every drink that I make is a little bit for him. Because my drink making philosophy is always, if you like it, that's what matters. And I'm going to make it with love. What you want and what will make you happy, I'm going to make that with passion and love and with my hands and with earnestness. Everything that I set out to do with art, that the art world is very like, no, we don't like that. We like when things are a little confusing, or only the elites get it, or only, you know, it's not meant to communicate too clearly. Like, I don't know. I like to communicate, like, I want you to be happy, and I made you this thing to make you happy. Every drink I make is a little bit for him. So I don't have to ask what that drink would be, because it's everyone.
Well, that kind of ties it back around to the Day of the Dead. You, every time you do that, it's in memory, in the spirit of Anthony Bourdain, which is what the Day of the Dead is all about, is remembering those people and the things around him, and that's the little bit of him that's in there in honor of this period.
Yeah. And again, I know it's not just me. I know, and I think it's awesome. I think it's amazing. It's beautiful how many people he resonated with, how many people had that door to the world open to them because of mm-hmm. him.
Yeah.
And I, as sad as the fact that he's gone makes me, you can't look at his life as a sad one, because he lives on in so many hands out there making food, making drinks.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a beautiful legacy, and I can only be grateful.
And anybody that watched him in his show or read his books has probably grown and learned from the things that he experienced.
Yeah. So, I will say, though, he did, when pushed, his favorite cocktail is a Negroni. Just, you know.
Well, all right.
So if you want to make a drink in honor to Anthony Bourdain, you should just make something you love. But if you're lost, then make a Negroni.
And not a Sblach one.
Spagliato, not a broken one. No, you like the classic
Spagliato
one.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, it's one of my favorite dudes, favorite writers, favorite creators. Deeply grateful for his influence on my life, and I'm sure many of you feel the same way. So this Dia de los Muertos, we are celebrating Anthony Bourdain.
Live on, dude. Party on, dude.
I'm sure somewhere he is, you know.
Yeah. Got to be.
All right. Well, hey, I got in that episode without crying too much. I was worried about.
All right. Well, good. I know that he's a special guy to you, and I know that you wanted to keep it upbeat and not let it get down. So I think you did a good job.
Well, hey, thank you, Dad, for joining me in this episode. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Tay, for having me. I enjoyed being a part of it and learning about him. I certainly learned more about him and his background than I knew before.
Yeah. You should check out that book you wanted, the Typhoid Mary book.
Yeah, I'd like to. Just like I say, we covered that case when I did Court Appointed, and I'd like to see about his fictional view of it.
Yeah. Or don't, because that's a real good Christmas present. So maybe forget we had this conversation.
Oh, okay.
Thank you all for joining us. Specifically, thank you to our patrons over on our Patreon. You are the reason this show gets made. If you're interested in that, please check that out if you'd like to help support the show. And if you'd like to, if you have questions, comments, whatever, you can find us on social media, NeedTheBoozeCast on Twitter and Instagram. You can also email us at NeedTheBoozeCast@gmail.com. And if you want to, hey, if you want to share your favorite story about the man himself, or just, you know, whatever, whoever you're remembering, whoever you're pouring one out for this Day of the Dead, you can do that
at Need the Boozecast group page on Facebook.
Do that, go there. Thank you again. I have been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Need. Love all those exotic things that everybody else was just curious about. They were not always great things to eat, but you never knew it looking at it.
Be respectful. I mean, it's again like how I feel about palate. Like, if you like it, then it's good. If you don't like it, then you don't like it. But you can't know what anybody else's palate is. Nobody gets the definitive palate, you know?
You know, his worst meal, he said, was an unwashed pig anus. So he was a brave man.
Well, and if you watch him eat that, because it's in an episode, you would never know. He is so respectful and grateful that he is being fed.
Well, he's a better man than me, because I know I'd react.
Wow, and that's why no one's lining up to feed you unwashed pig anus on network television.
Thank you very much.